welcome to this Tuesday of Thanksgiving Week edition of Main Street here on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a bit later in the show, Dr. Tom Ezern stops by for another of his Plains Folk essays. Dr. Ezern reflects on the perilous work of prairie well diggers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Plus, Rick Yeon joins me in the Main Street studio. We're talking Thanksgiving food on the most recent edition of Prairie Plates. But first, since January of 2013, Kirsten Basler has served as North Dakota's Superintendent of Public Instruction, and she was reelected to that position earlier this month and joins us today on Main Street. Superintendent, congratulations on your reelection.
Thank you so much, Craig. I just want to say thanks to everyone in North Dakota for their vote of confidence in me. I was just going around our office this morning, telling everybody on the team how grateful I am for all the work that they do, and wishing them a happy Thanksgiving. And I just reminded, you know, how blessed I am to be able to do this work for the students of North Dakota with this fantastic team that is with me at the department. So thanks to everyone out there. We look forward to serving for another 4 years.
Madam Superintendent, you oversee 168 school districts in the state and some non-public schools as well. And President Trump has expressed a desire to eliminate the Department of Education, arguing that education oversight should be returned to the states to allow for localized, individualized approaches. The president-elect has nominated Linda McMahon to lead the Department of Education. And while she has not publicly advocated for disbanding the agency herself, she's expected to align with President-elect Trump's agenda to transfer educational control back to the states. And our goal here today is to understand what all of that might mean for North Dakota. So if you would, Superintendent, set the stage for us and let us know how much money annually from the federal government and its current impact to our state.
Certainly. I appreciate that opportunity very much. I think that there's a lot of speculation. I think we can ground our conversation today in fact and what is, and maybe alleviate some fears and actually provide some hopefulness too, because I do certainly agree that the responsibility for education does belong with the states. And I think there's some tremendous opportunity to make sure that that happens during this administration. But we really do want to talk about the facts and what's possible with an executive order or our administration dictate and or what is requiring congressional control. So to the question of how much funding does the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education provide, or the Congress provide through the Department of Education, it's about 10% of the total cost to educate a student in the state of North Dakota. So each student is funded for about a little over $14,000 per per school year per student. And about 10% of that is covered by the U.S. Department of Education through a congressional appropriation. And those are mainly for programs that are in law, in our federal register that are required by Congress, dealing specifically with two different areas, most primarily the area of IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act from the early 1970s. So that's our students with disabilities, our students with special needs. And the other dates back to the mid-1960s when President Johnson signed the act that the Elementary Secondary Education Act that was trying to eradicate poverty and was using education to do that. So those are what we call our Title I funds. So the primary delivery of federal dollars to our North Dakota schools are to support our students that are disadvantaged economically and to support our students who have disabilities or learning special learning needs. And so I think that there's lots of opportunity, but that's where we're at financially.
So when the president then makes this suggestion that the federal agency should be disbanded, what are the practical and then political challenges of shutting down that department? And in your view, Madam Superintendent, how realistic is that proposal in today's context?
So think that this President-elect Trump is not the first president or presidential candidate to make the desire and state politically that they want to shut down the U.S. Department of Education. And so we hear this often. I'd say that I've heard it in the last 4 to 5 presidential election cycles that I've been involved with education policy. So this statement or this goal is not anything new that we've heard from presidential candidates. But as we've all seen, you know, President Trump is not a traditional candidate, and we do expect that he will he will take some steps that may have maybe will take it a little bit further than other presidential candidates would have taken. But we have to be clear that eliminating the U.S. Department of Education would require a congressional vote, and most likely including 60 or more votes in the Senate. So the president, any president, cannot simply by mandate or dictate eliminate that Department of Education. So Congress would need to vote on that. They would need to take that action, likely take 60 or more votes. And the honest truth is that even among Republicans, there isn't a unified approach to whether or not the department should be eliminated. So even the Republicans do control the Senate right now, but even the Republicans aren't all lockstep on this idea of whether the U.S. Department of Education should be eliminated or not. I personally think that there are tremendous ways that the U.S. Department of Education's authority, reach, scope, however you want to describe that, can be significantly minimized and streamlined. And I think my administration at the Department of Public Instruction in North Dakota provides some really good examples of reining back in that mission creep and really aligning to the mission, our existing mission of student outcomes on reading, writing, and mathematics. And so I'd be happy to go into some of those, some ideas. I do think that there is great opportunity that this administration, as a president, and of course, the secretary, nominee Linda McMahon could do to significantly reduce the size and operation of our U.S. Department of Education and return much of the control and decision-making authority to the states where it belongs.
Madam Superintendent, critics argue that decentralizing educational oversight to the states could then exacerbate inequalities. And I think you have some thoughts about that. And specifically, what are your thoughts on the balance between state and federal roles then in education in the years to come? Should the federal government have a role?
So certainly, as I talked about, there are two federal laws that are in existence right now. That is to protect our students with disabilities, our students with special needs. Our government has declared, and until Congress changes that, that is the rules and the expectations that we operate under. And I don't see anything changing as far as our federal government's responsibility towards ensuring that there is equity for our students with disabilities. I also don't see any rolling back of the federal government's expectation and responsibility for helping our students in poverty and trying to eliminate that through our Title I funds, helping and assisting our students who attend schools that are socially and economically disadvantaged. But here's where the but is. I do think that there is federal overreach and mission creep, probably to be more specific, in some responsibilities and some actions that our U.S. Education Department has taken recently. Our federal student loan program, for example, $1.7 trillion of student loan debt in this nation, that is not something that education experts are skilled at or have the best expertise at. I believe that these programs should be moved to the Treasury Department, where there are people that are in that department that have experience, expertise, and frankly, degrees and education on banking and lending practices. I also believe that the data collection that our U.S. Education Department is doing right now is far beyond their mission creep, and I think that there's some significant efficiencies that we could garner when we talk about data collection and reporting on educational statistics. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does a fantastic job with very little delay and very little turnaround time, very little bureaucracy that could absorb some of the data collection and reporting on educational statistics and become more efficient. And then I think finally, the thing that people most often talk about as we talk about the Education Department in recent administrations is the civil rights enforcement in education. Their civil rights is a mainstay of our country. It's something that we embrace and needs to be embraced. But that civil rights enforcement, very similar to the way that we approach the enforcement of our state rules and regulations, and even our federal rules and regulations, the people at the Department of Public Instruction in North Dakota, we're not law enforcement. we're not trained in investigations. And to do so would be really inefficient government. It would be duplication of services. And so what we have done for the last 10 years is partner with our local state's attorneys and with our attorney general's office. When we do the monitoring for our school districts and our programs that they are expected to implement, when we see a potential violation, we don't recreate a whole investigative arm in the state of North Dakota's Department of Public Instruction. We partner with our law enforcement agencies, and particularly our attorney generals. I think there's great opportunity to do that with our Department of Justice as well. And so I think I come from a good space to actually talk about this, Craig. In the last, as you mentioned, I took office in 2013. And while the department was filled with really good, well-intentioned people, we had overreached and grown beyond our mission of supporting our schools for our mission of education. And over the course of that 12 years, we've been able to reduce our education staff from 101 employees down to 82. So nearly a 20% decrease while getting better and delivering better services to our schools and the students in those schools. So I think that,
Madam Superintendent,
that's what I think we're talking about.
Madam Superintendent, there's been an argument that there's been undue influence on local curriculum because of the federal government's role in funding education. Do you believe that to be true? And if you do, what should be changed relative to how local curriculums are influenced by the federal government?
So that is something that we've been vigilant about. I know some states do have prescribed curriculums. They have a list of textbooks and or resources that school districts must purchase if they are going to be using state or federal funds. North Dakota has no such mandate. We have no such list. And we have, along with our legislators, have just, as I said, been diligent about pushing back that curriculum influence. So at this point in time, our local school boards, along with their communities and their superintendent leadership team, determine the curriculum. And by curriculum, we mean all resources, all books, all materials. Those are locally decided, and all school districts in North Dakota are required by state law, by North Dakota law, to have a curriculum selection process that includes community members. With that being said, I think that there has been some social influence and some maybe political influence, if you will, in trying to use grants. And I would say that I saw a lot of that under the Obama administration, my first year in office, where we had Race to the Top grants, and you were only eligible to apply for their specialized grants if you were going to do A, B, or C, or X, Y, or Z. And so that is where I've seen the most, I would say, unfair influence coming from our federal government, having these additional grant opportunities to help students or help states, and then exerting very specific requirements within the grant applications. So the answer to that is simple. It simplifies our funding formula, and it puts control back with the states, and the states can then use that state control to further perpetuate that control to our states. And that's block grants. Instead of the formula grants or the specialized grants, I believe that there should be block grants given for our special education, our IDEA funds, and our Title I funds for students that are economically disadvantaged. This would give North Dakota the flexibility to prioritize the programs that align with our unique needs. Our needs are different than they are in Texas or in North Carolina or in California. So we have a very strong need to support our rural schools, our Native American students, and specifically the Choice Ready framework that we've embraced across this state for college ready, work ready, or military ready. So these block grants would give North Dakota that flexibility without the federal micromanagement that sometimes creeps into the funding streams from USED.
We are enjoying our conversation with Superintendent of Public Instruction, Kirsten Basler. She served in that office since 2013 and was just reelected to serve in the position for another 4 years. Madam Superintendent, you talked a little bit ago about size of government, and do you perceive you'll start to feel pressure to really grow your office if, in fact, then the federal government reduces its role in, I guess, providing the services that are required by law that you've outlined, et cetera, et cetera? Are you concerned that then here it comes, it's on your plate, in a sense, an unfunded mandate? Are you worried about that in this particular environment?
So actually, just exactly the opposite. Just as I've done for the last 12 years in office, I will continue to look for efficiencies and staying aligned to our mission of education and not trying to get into other social areas or law enforcement or other areas where we don't belong, like banking and lending. And I actually see just the opposite. There's so much of our team's time that is spent because of the micromanaging system that is set up right now. There is a tremendous amount of effort and energy that is expended by my team at the Department of Public Instruction here because our federal government is micromanaging and they want very specific reports on how our school districts are doing. And so the monitoring, whether in desk auditing that are required to meet the requirements of the micromanaging from our federal government, that's what is, you know, lack of a more refined word, sucking all of our good time away. And this is one thing that I've told every administration since I've been in office. Obviously, I've worked under the Obama administration, then the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, and now looking forward to a Trump administration in January. But in each of those administrations, I have said time and time again that our U.S. Education Department is leapfrogging over our state education agencies. In North Dakota, we call that DPI. Our U.S. Education Department is placing mandates directly on our local education agencies, what we call school districts in the state, and then expecting that the state monitor and enforce the micromanaged mandates that our federal government is placing on our local schools. And so this bypassing of our state education agency creates some extremely unnecessary burdens and extreme inefficiencies, leaving states without the adequate flexibility to implement these programs effectively. So by restoring SEAs as the primary point of accountability, the resources that we have in our department can be better aligned with our state and local priorities, and we can spend more of our time supporting our schools to deliver excellent services that our families expect and deserve for their children instead of the bureaucratic micromanaging of specific reporting mandates. We can focus on results.
I want to ask you about public perception of this issue. I think across the country, some people believe this is an attack on public schools and teachers. A, have you felt that here in North Dakota? And B, do you believe this is a push to have more private schools and to maybe perhaps, in a way, have private schools better funded across the country and also here in North Dakota?
So I don't believe I feel pressure to acquiesce to just a simple, you know, private school voucher. What I do see, and obviously I'm a servant of the constituents and this a servant most primarily of our students that actually can't even vote. They're 0 to 18, so they can't even vote. So that's who I serve. What I do feel pressure, and I feel that it's good pressure. It's needed pressure. And I place this pressure on myself, my team. I placed it on myself as a classroom teacher, as an elementary assistant principal, and as a district school board president. We have got to continue to get better. I've seen increased expectations for our school districts. I think the pandemic, that experience allowed a lot of family members to take a peek under the hood, if you will, of our school system. And I do believe that there is an expectation, and again, a justified expectation for the great investment our state invests, you know, $2.5 billion each biennium in education in our state. It's funded very well. I feel very blessed when I visit with my colleagues from across the nation from other states that aren't funded to that degree. So I would say no. I think that there's not a pressure to that. It's a private versus public or an attack on public schools. People love their public schools. They absolutely do. But does everybody expect the highest of delivery of services and want and expect our schools to be responsive to what our students need or is a family, what their specific and individual child needs? Yes, I see an increase in an expectation of a more individualized and a personally fit education that is relevant to our students these days, and parents and families are demanding that. So I see this as an opportunity for, you know, iron sharpens iron, right? And we have an opportunity to get better. If school districts aren't being responsive, public school districts aren't being responsive, sometimes a market or competition does sharpen the saw, if you will, and helps everybody get better. I was speaking with a local school superintendent from the Valley area, and a large percent of his students are open enrolled from other school districts. And he says it best. If you are a good school district providing good services to your students and your families and being responsive to your family's needs, you have nothing to worry about. You are a good school and they will choose you.
Madam Superintendent, you learned with the rest of us on election night that Measure 4 failed and was not successful, which would have eliminated property taxes in the state. That said, now how property taxes are administered seems to be a priority of a new administration. What changes do you advocate now in how public education and the construction and maintenance of schools should be funded and should be changed now in North Dakota?
Certainly. So as you are likely well aware, we've been all hearing there's going to be a significantly high number of bill proposals that will be filed that will deal with the property tax issue. You've heard from our governor-elect Armstrong, Congressman Armstrong, that it is a priority and it's his number one priority as his new administration takes their role in mid-December. So my role right now is to work with our legislators. In fact, I have had several meetings set up this week alone, even with a short week, with legislators coming in, needing to look at the numbers. I do think our school districts will be looked at as one of the mechanisms to try to deliver property tax relief to our homeowners and to our property owners in the state. And so our role at the department right now, as we move through this session, is to provide the answers, the data, and the information that our legislators need to craft good bills to file, and then to debate those bills as it moves through. I do suspect that there will be some analysis of our funding formula. Are we adequately funding the building constructions? I know that, as you know, not all mills are created equal, and some of our school districts are really struggling to pass bond issues or even have the ability to levy without a mill levy cap, the amount of funding that it's going to take to do just basic maintenance to update some of our older buildings. And so I think transportation will be investigated in totality of what it costs. I think the trend that we'll see is what is the basic amount. Right now we're funding on a per pupil formula. I think what we'll see is what does the state owe and what is the state's responsibility for putting a roof over the head, heating buildings, putting textbooks and materials, a good quality teacher in front of no more than 25 students for our fifth and sixth graders, no more than 18 students for our kindergartners. What are the costs that the state does need to have for the basic responsibilities, and then striking a deal with local entities, local public subdivisions to say, and then all the extras, that's where you would be responsible for doing anything extra. So that's the trend I'm seeing in the conversations that I'm having with legislators, but it certainly will be a significant, if not the main point of conversation during this upcoming legislative session.
We're enjoying our conversation with the Superintendent of Public Instruction in North Dakota, Kirsten Basler. She was reelected to the position earlier this month, and we're going to continue our conversation with the superintendent right after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're continued to be joined by Kirsten Basler. She is North Dakota's Superintendent of Public Instruction. We've discussed earlier in the show the potential impact of what the elimination of a federal Department of Education might mean, and the superintendent has given us her thoughts about that. And now we're turning to what's currently happening in the Department of Education here in North Dakota. Madam Superintendent, in the short term, what do you perceive might be different in a Kelly Armstrong administration as it relates to your department compared to maybe how Governor Burgum spoke with you, I guess, planned with you about education in our state?
That's a wonderful question. I'm very optimistic. As we talked about briefly, I've served under three different presidential administrations. I will now be serving under three different governor administrations as well. I came in and served my first term with Governor Jack Dalrymple, then obviously Governor Burgum, and now Governor-elect Armstrong. I've been very fortunate to have all my first two governors be extremely dedicated and committed to education. Governor Dalrymple, as you know, as the lieutenant governor, led the Education Commission to stay the first lawsuit. As we talk about funding formula and property taxes, Lieutenant Governor Dalrymple was tasked with the responsibility of staying a lawsuit, an equity lawsuit. And so, and the First Lady, Betsy Dalrymple, being a former kindergarten teacher herself, education was very important to them. So very good, close working relationship. Also a very respectful relationship about us, you know, being not me not being part of the governor's cabinet, but being an executive branch leader along with them. Governor Burgum, as you know, had one of his pillars, in addition to the Main Street pillar and tribal relations, education, transforming education was one of his pillars as well. He too also had a very good working relationship with him, continued throughout his two terms. We were friends before. Interestingly, Governor Burgum, before he had any idea of running for governor, he was one of my biggest supporters in the 2012 election. He had shot a video supporting me, held a fundraiser for me, and was excited. And so when he came into office, he really assisted and lifted, amplified with his stronger bully pulpit, the work that we were trying to do. Governor-elect Armstrong, again, I can't say enough about our working relationship. He was a state senator when I was the state superintendent, continued that strong working relationship. He helped me clear through a lot of things on the federal side when he was out serving in Congress. And so I expect the same sort of high regard and priority being placed on education and the same strong working relationship between our two agencies.
Will consolidation of school districts be a priority of yours to gain additional efficiencies, Madam Superintendent?
So I don't believe the consolidation of school districts with a rural state like ours. What I do think is some consolidation of some administrative duties and tasks. For instance, sharing of business managers, sharing of superintendents. I know that there was a bill last session that was heavily opposed by our North Dakota Council of Educational Leaders. That's our group of superintendents and principals. And so it was defeated. And a do not pass coming out of that committee. But I think the idea or the understanding of the number of superintendents and the number of business managers that we have, I think that's the first time people took a look at it. So I don't really see a consolidation effort moving forward, but I do see an expectation of our local school boards to find some greater efficiencies by sharing, you know, not only of administrative leaders or superintendents and having a building principal present in every building, but having a superintendent, you know, similar to, you know, many states actually have that county system of county superintendents that there is. Florida, for example, I think has the county system. They only have like 40 district superintendents because it's a countywide system, whereas they have a building principal in every building to do the instructional leadership. I think that we'll see some expectations of partnering a little bit more closely, possibly using our regional education agencies as is a conduit for that gap, that bridge gap. I also see with our teacher shortage that they're in that type of scenario. Two smaller school districts that live, you know, that are maybe located 15, 20 miles apart could actually share an English teacher or those coveted math and science teachers. I know in Bismarck, it's one school district. It's got, I don't know, 18 elementary schools right now and three high schools, an alternative school. And sometimes those specialists, whether they be a special education teacher, they drive from Lincoln, the town of Lincoln, all the way up to North Bismarck to Century High School or to Highland Acres Elementary School to share services. And oftentimes those drives are a lot longer than 15 or 20 minutes. And so I think it's possible. We just need to think more innovatively.
You contributed to the work of the Teacher Retention and Recruitment Task Force. It's announced its initial report. Have the issues been solved, or are you really concerned that North Dakota will still experience issues relative to the teacher shortage you just talked about?
So I just actually heard a research report that came out of Edunomics, Georgetown University's Edunomics, and they have projected that nationally the teacher shortage or the teacher shortage crisis is now over. A lot of people were hired with the additional COVID funding dollars, our ESSER dollars part of the three COVID relief acts. And so there will be some of those jobs and positions will be eliminated. That's the national scene. I still think we had a teacher shortage before COVID. We have a teacher shortage after during COVID, and we will have one afterwards. But I am optimistic. I think the recommendations will be looked at and considered seriously by our legislature and the new governor's administration, those nine recommendations. I believe that the program that the Department of Public Instruction started just before COVID and then was augmented and with the extra COVID dollars, which is our teacher apprenticeship and our Grow Your Own program. Right now, we have just under 300 teachers that were paraprofessionals that are either licensed teachers now or in the program to become licensed teachers in the very schools and the very rural communities that they were working as paraprofessionals. And so I think innovative programs like that, partnering with our higher ed, I think North Dakota is ahead of the curve on that and will continue to be innovative. So I think there's, we really do have to, number one, pay them well enough and lift them up as a profession that we celebrate again. I think that there was a time where our teachers weren't feeling valued or celebrated, and we, as each and every one of us, can play a role in that. It doesn't take money. It just, it takes goodwill on every single 780,000 North Dakota citizens to make sure that our teachers are feeling valued and respected.
Besides the challenge of retaining and offering teachers their initial positions to get enough teachers in the state, what do you perceive your biggest challenges are going to be in the next 4 years?
Boy, goodness, I think it's going to be to scale out the work that we've done in the personalized competency-based learning. We have a pocket full of districts that are taking advantage of those opportunities to operate more like a charter school with some autonomy and flexibility. Our state law allows that for all of our public schools, but it's a lot of work to do that. It's hard work to undo some learning of the way that we've done school and then rebuild our learning. And so to better support them with through some sort of an intermediary and scale that good work, I think the property tax issue is going to be continue to be beyond just this session. We're going to have to keep an eye on that. And I think really making sure that we continue our recovery for our students. We have got to accomplish our mission. Our mission, the reason we exist as an entity, is to ensure that our students can read, write, do math, think critically, have scientific inquiry, all of those things that are education-centric. We owe it to our children to graduate choice-ready, so they are prepared to do with the skills, the knowledge, and the personality traits to enter and be successful in college, enter the work world, or join the military and be successful. We've got to keep our eye on that ball. That's the reason we exist, and it will be a significant responsibility to ensure that we continue to trend in the right direction upward and make sure that all of our students are graduating, that 100% of our students are graduating choice ready. So that's what's on our plate.
Are you confident too, relative to physical structures, the trend towards not wanting to fund schools perhaps with property taxes, or as we've discussed, maybe the state playing a better role? Are you at all concerned that our facilities aren't keeping up? Is that also a major priority for you?
That certainly is, Craig. We have been studying that during the interim. I know that there's a coalition of states, both Western and Eastern. It's interesting which school districts. It's not geographic, as some people might think, that it's only the eastern part of the state or only the central part of the state. There's geographic diversity of school districts that are struggling to maintain the upkeep of their basic structural buildings. And so that will be part of the funding. It will be part of the funding conversation in both our appropriation and our policy committees, but it will most certainly be part of the property tax relief conversation as well. We're looking at other models. Wyoming has some models. I believe Kansas does some different things. We can, you know, that there isn't going to be a plug and play, if you will. What's working in Wyoming or Kansas is not going to be the perfect fit, but there are some examples out there. It's going to be up to us and incumbent upon us, our responsibility to take the best ideas and create something that is distinctly and uniquely North Dakotan that fits our needs.
Relative to Wyoming, before we go, you know that that's where I hail from. I never once voted on a school bond issue. The state built schools. Now, if a school district wanted amenities that weren't covered by this basic style of school, if you will, then perhaps a school district may have a bond issue, but I never needed to vote on one. Is that the way it should ultimately be here, or do you perceive the public will still have a role if it needs perhaps a new elementary school?
I think we're not going to have, I think, and this is part of what we've discussed during the interim the interim legislative session. We've looked at Wyoming extensively. The legislators have looked at Wyoming extensively. There isn't a huge appetite to turn complete control over to the state. So your building projects go on a state list in a different entity it in some people's minds, and I think that there's value in that. That creates
It's called the State
layer.
School Facilities Commission, by the way.
Yes, exactly. The state schools, another entity would need to be created. Some people see that as growing government and adding bureaucracy, where suddenly Gwinner doesn't get to decide for itself what repairs or improvements are necessary. They have to submit their request to a state commission, and then the commission decides where on the priority list. And so I don't see an appetite for returning full control over to the state, but I do see somewhat of a hybrid where there's a recommendations where the state will cover some parts of it that weren't covered before, and then the local community can then decide if, as you said, they want extras and or that there is a vote that is determined whether or not they will accept the state funds or they will do it locally. So I see somewhat of a hybrid, a compromise, which is when you use the word, I know a lot of people think that the word compromise is not a good word. Still, I'm a believer of when you find compromise, that means that you've landed on a good solution. And I that's the way I appreciate North Dakota operating.
Kirsten Basler is our state superintendent of public instruction. Madam Superintendent, how are you going to spend Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving dinner family table has grown. I thought that it was just originally going to be my sister and her husband from Virginia and my other sister that lives in Mandan, but I will be hosting my son and his girlfriend and my daughter-in-law and my three granddaughters. Unfortunately, my one twin son is a firefighter, a career firefighter for the city of Dickinson. So he is on shift, making sure that if any turkeys, go on fire, any deep fried turkeys go on fire, that he will be able to respond. And my other son is out in California as a traveling healthcare professional. He's a speech therapist. And so he will be home with us for Christmas. But in a nutshell, short answer, I am making the traditional turkey and the stuffing and the mashed potatoes and gravy and all the fixings that go along with it. Really looking forward to having my family with me, and so grateful for all the blessings that we have this year.
Well, we certainly wish you and your family a happy Thanksgiving, Madam Superintendent. Thank you so much for joining us again on Main Street. Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Plainsfolk essay, Dr. Tom Ezern reflects on the perilous work of prairie well diggers in the late 19th and early 20th century. Their heroism often went hand in hand with tragedy. Through vivid historical accounts, Dr. Ezern explores how these laborers earned a place of respect and awe in a society that depended on their dangerous craft.
In July of 1885, a settler named John Blasky was 22 feet down in a well he was excavating on his farm near Conway, Walsh County. He was filling buckets with dirt, and his wife was at the surface drawing them up with a windlass. Early in the evening, Mr. Blasky shouted up he wasn't feeling well, and his wife drew him up. Before long, he said he felt better, and against his wife's advice, went back down the well. Foul air, as the paper said, toxic gas, overcame him before he reached bottom, and he fell from the bucket. Mrs. Blasky brought neighbors to help. One of them bravely started a descent on the bucket, began to faint, and was saved by the hand of his son reaching down for him. Another neighbor arrived, announced, "Well, I can stand it," commenced a descent of rescue, but himself passed out and fell dead at the bottom of the well. Still another neighbor tried to go down, this one with a safety rope attached, and was hauled up when he passed out. Eventually, an experienced well digger arrived and extracted the corpses with ropes and hooks. Thus, the death toll stopped at 2. The newspapers of the settlement era are full of stories like this. Over near Mitchell, the same year, 1885, Fred Steendorf and his 16-year-old son, said to be professional well diggers, died. the father overcome with gas, the son by falling from the bucket trying to rescue his father. The next year, near Larimore, a Canadian well digger named Philip H. Green was killed by falling from the bucket, overcome by gas. Over at Oaks in 1891, a young man named Martin Pearson sensed gas when halfway down a 46-foot deep shaft, signaled to be brought up, but passed out and fell to the bottom unconscious. His partner dashed water onto him, and he revived enough to clutch the bucket and ride to the surface, a survivor. In Griggs County in 1895, well digger Albert Frick was in a 45-feet deep well when it caved in, breaking his arm in three places. He survived to have the fracture set by the local doctor. In 1897, Lars Lebo of Ramsey County had his skull crushed when the windlass atop the well he was working in collapsed. The same year, William Albert, working on a well near Cullum, drowned when the water level rose abruptly. 1904, the well digger William S. Smith died on a claim northwest of Williston, overcome, the papers said, by foul air. Another digger died from the same cause that year at Norwich, and still another, Tom Brace, in Morton County. On a farm near Sawyer in 1906, the well digger Jacob Tomlinson started down a 90-foot deep well and was overcome by gas, falling to his death. His body became wedged at the bottom of the well such that it could not be retrieved until the next day. Despite all such grisly tales, press reports and popular regard assigned well diggers an oddly heroic place in prairie society. They spoke of far-famed well diggers, noted their comings and goings, eagerly sought their services, and occasionally made jokes about their drinking habits, but overall expressed something like awe for their hard work and fearlessness. It seems that a certain loss of life in deep holes was counted the necessary cost to secure pure water for the emergent prairie society.
That's Dr. Tom Ezern. He's a longtime friend of Prairie Public and a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Prairie Plates is next.
I like bagels.
There's the music we look forward to. It's another edition of Prairie Plates, usually on Wednesdays. This week it's on Tuesday because Thanksgiving compresses things just a little bit for us here at Prairie Public. But Rick Yellen joins me in the Main Street studio. Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
Hey, this is one of my favorite weeks of the year. Rick, what's your favorite way to make your turkey?
I just like it oven roasted. I think it's the best way. And if you want to inject it or brine it, hey, more power to you. But I really just like an oven roasted turkey. A lot of people like to spatchcock them and smoke them. They're very good that way too. But I just like a traditional turkey, not stuffed with stuffing. The dressing needs to be on the side, but you know, you probably want to put an onion, carrot, celery, that sort of thing in there just for a little bit of flavor. But that's where I'm at on that.
My favorite memory of Thanksgiving, A, it made our house smell so good because my mom would put the turkey in like at midnight and get up and baste it and really cook it slow. So when we woke up, the house was smelling great. Two, I always got the gizzard and the neck. So that was like my appetizer, but I looked forward to that. This is just such a fun time of year for food. For me, Rick, turkey, mashed potatoes, and then pumpkin pie, and I'm all set. Everything else is just gravy. Ha ha.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, you got all the major food groups there, in my opinion.
So what are you doing for Thanksgiving, Rick?
Usually I go out to southwestern North Dakota and hang out with some friends and family. There's some traditions out there. But this year, due to grad school papers, I'm sticking around town. I'll spend a little time with my mom. We're not going to do a whole heck of a lot. We'll go out and probably I'll spend some time over at her place for a little while. Usually it's a large meal, a couple turkeys, maybe a ham, sometimes some lamb involved, a lot of meatballs. It's a big to-do, and it's kind of on down the list from appetizers, down the main course, down the desserts. It goes over numerous hours. I mean, you kind of get hungry, again, after a few hours watching those movies, you work up kind of a hunger. So that's kind of a tradition of ours over the Thanksgiving break. And this is my favorite holiday. July 4th is the other one, but this is my favorite holiday for obvious reasons.
Okay, I'm going to bust on you, Rick. Movies? Football, man. got to watch the parade and football on Thanksgiving, don't we?
Well, there's a lot of that stuff that goes on, flipping back and forth. And, you know, sometimes there's things on in the basement and the man cave, and then upstairs there's movies, downstairs there's football. So you can kind of move around, which is probably pretty good unless you just want to sit there and take a nap. But yeah, multiple levels, multiple floors, that sort of thing. And yeah, you gotta kind of have some variety, in my opinion.
Your favorite dessert, Rick?
Just pie, pumpkin pie, apple pie. I really enjoy pecan pie. And please serve it with real whipped cream. I don't want Cool Whip on it. Ice cream is great too. Homemade ice cream is even better. But yes, real whipped cream. You got to have real whipped cream.
My mom would always make these huge turkeys, 20, 21, 22 pounds.
Ooh.
And so it was Thanksgiving, the day after. And then here we come with turkey noodle soup and some other things. It just lasted for a week or so, and she loved it so much. We did the same thing at Christmas, and I think that for some of our family, that's maybe a little too much turkey. Let's do something else on Christmas and not a turkey again. So for us, it's prime rib during the Christmas holiday. Reminder to everyone, boy, if you haven't gotten it out of the freezer yet, you might be a little too late.
Yes. Yeah,
it takes time.
You might want to put that thing in the garage. Well, I don't even know if it would defrost due to our weather, but yeah, it takes a little time, especially if they get into the 20-pound range. That's a big bird.
It is. Your favorite side dish as we wrap it up for Thanksgiving, Rick?
Well, I really like mashed potatoes, dressing, and gravy combo, those three. One thing I really enjoy, though, when I'm out in southwestern North Dakota is a friend of mine makes this fermented cranberry sauce, and I know it sounds weird, and you just kind of whir it up in the food processor, and it's cranberries, oranges, and stuff like that, little sugar, but he lets it ferment for a couple days, and it gives this real nice zing to it, and it's definitely an interesting twist on the traditional cranberry sauce, so that's kind of become a favorite over the years. When one of my grandmothers was still alive, a tradition of ours was to make a lasagna, too, and that's kind of prevalent, but she was Italian, and so that was one of the family traditions of ours that I actually really miss.
A good lasagna always works for me, Rick. We've had another edition of Prairie Plates, Thanksgiving edition of Prairie Plates with Rick Guillen. Rick, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us again on Main Street.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 26th. On this date, in 1896, the Jamestown paper reported Mrs. Swain had been taken home to New Rockford for burial. She and her lover were found dead in a Valley City hotel room. A note left at the scene said, "You will find sufficient funds in my pocketbook to bury us. Our last request is to bury us together without any fuss, and do not try to find out who we are. Parted in life, but joined in death." Cause of death was prussic acid ingestion. Mrs. Swain was thought to have become mentally deranged. She had four children and one of the finest homes in Eddy County. Mr. Swain had large land holdings and was one of the most prosperous farmers in the area. He was described as a kind and loving husband who knew of his wife's irrational infatuation with Frank Addison. He reportedly tried to reason with her to no avail. Addison was hired by Mr. Swain a year earlier to care for his stock while he went east. Upon return, he discovered Addison had stolen the affections of his wife. Mr. Swain said that Addison had his wife entirely under his control and followed her around with a pistol and a bottle of prussic acid in his pockets. Mrs. Swain told her husband that she could not live with him and would rather die with Addison. The couple arrived by train on Wednesday. They registered at the hotel as Mr. and Mrs. Owens. They were not seen again by hotel staff until Friday, when the door to their room was forced open. According to the Valley City paper, the dead lovers were locked in each other's arms. Each had a picture of the other tucked under their clothes. Frank Addison was buried at Valley City. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you've spent time with us. Coming on Wednesday's Main Street, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein will stop by the Main Street studio for our monthly edition of Philosophical Currents. Our topic, community and family dynamics around Thanksgiving. Also, Matt Olean reviews the movie Wicked. Sure waiting for that. We hope you can join us again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.